You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer.
Hey everybody, it's Ken Davenport. I wanted to make sure you heard the news that I'm bringing the Deaf West production of Spring Awakening to Broadway in the fall. If you love Spring Awakening, you wait until you see this production because you've never seen anything like it. Deaf West is one of the most innovative theater companies I've ever worked with and ever seen, and their production of Spring Awakening is mind-blowing. Check it out. Go to Ticketmaster.com, get tickets. Oof, I got a lot of work to do. Okay, on with the podcast.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Ken Davenport here. You're listening to the Producer's Perspective podcast, which, by the way, when you have some time, you should try saying that five times fast. It is not the easiest name of a podcast. And if you'd like to do it right now, I'll wait. No, we won't wait. And we won't wait because my guest is way too important to waste your time. Welcome to the Producer's Perspective podcast, the brilliant playwright Teresa Rebeck. Welcome, Teresa.
Hi, I'm so pleased to be here.
I just called Teresa a playwright, and of course she is one, but she is so much more than that. What I love about her is she actually runs her creative career like a business, diversifying her own portfolio over a number of mediums. Yes, she's written many Broadway plays, including Mauritius, Dead Accounts, and The Fantastic Seminar, which is one of my favorites over the last several years, and even more off-Broadway plays, including co-writing Omnium Gatherum, which was a Pulitzer finalist. But she has also written copious amounts of television, including for such shows as Third Watch, Brooklyn Bridge, L.A. Law, and was the creator of the only Broadway-themed primetime television show I know, Smash. She's written novels, movies. See, I told you, we're wasting her time, so we should just get to it. If you want to read more about her, check out her website, teresarebeck.com. So, Teresa, let's start at the beginning. When did you decide you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, I was really young. I was somebody who wanted to be a writer when I was 6 years old. You know, it was peculiarly something that appeared in my imagination very, very early. I don't remember when I didn't want to be a writer. I would drift in and out of other ideas, but it was always sort of the baseline thing that I wanted to do. And then when I was in high school, I started acting a lot. So there was a period of time when I felt like maybe I wanted to be an actress, just like everybody has that moment. And there was just a moment where I thought, oh, I could be a writer and in the theater. That makes me a playwright. And it was sort of like A plus B equals C. And that's the last time I had any sort of clarity about it. But I went to my mother and I said, I think I want to be a playwright, when I must have been 16. And she went pale. I mean, she looked sort of shocked and horrified. I was in Cincinnati, Ohio. So there weren't a lot of people. I didn't know any playwrights. It was a peculiar thing to dream up.
And do you remember the first play you wrote?
The first play I wrote, I was doing a lot of, at the time in high school, I went to this really crazy Catholic high school that was run by a bunch of nuns. And they were like liberation theologists, all of them. They were these radical nuns. And it was an all-girls school, and they thought we could do anything. It was kind of an extraordinary place. You didn't know it at the time. So they had us doing, creating pieces with my fellow students and doing them for the, just for the school at the assemblies and stuff. So I think that would be the first time I wrote anything but we were all just out of our minds. We were doing nutty stuff. And then in college, I sort of knew, I was out there at the University of Notre Dame of all places, and I had the idea that I would be a playwright, but they didn't actually have a playwriting program. They were kind of, they would circle it in really abstract ways. But the great Julie Jensen was on the staff there, and she was sort of a mentor of mine, and I kept bugging her to have a playwriting class. And so they started this playwriting class. And in retrospect, I'm convinced they started it for me, but I'm sure it was a little more complicated than that. So I studied with Julie and wrote my first sort of, actual, just sit down and write a play, take a crack at it, was when I was an undergraduate, in the more formal sense of the word. And she was a great teacher. She's a wonderful writer herself.
Where do you get your ideas for your plays? Where do they come from?
That's a really good question. People ask that question. I think the general answer is no one knows. You know what I mean? That there's a real mystery around where anyone gets their ideas. And there's, a large body of work examining that question. The Greeks would invoke the muse. Some people say it's God. Some people say it's your subconscious. But they do kind of rise up. A lot of times, I have a lot of ideas. I think that, people say to me sometimes, you're so prolific. And I'm like, I have a lot on my mind. And they come a lot. And a friend of mine actually said to me one time, Teresa, the muse likes you. And I thought, that's actually true. I'm sort of constantly getting smacked upside the head with another idea. And sometimes, I go through periods where there was one period when I was writing for actors, for specific people a lot. I worked with Julie White several times, and there was clearly an affinity between her instrument and my language. And then I had a moment where I thought, I'd like to write, it was almost mathematical in a kind of backward sense. I was thinking, I'd like to write a novel. I've always been curious about that. And then I thought, you don't know how to write a novel. You're never going to be able to do that. And then I thought, well, if it was like, a first-person novel, like there's been some great ones, Call Me Ishmael, it could be like one long monologue. And then I thought, you've never even written a long monologue or a one-person show. And then I thought, I could write a one-person show. And then I thought, I should write a one-person show for Julie. She could, be amazing. And then there was so I called her up and I said, I'm going to write a one-woman show for you. And she thought, she was charmed by the idea, but I think people say a lot of things and they don't necessarily come through with them. So then one night I went over to her house and we talked about what it might be, but she was clearly somebody who should have a one-person show written on her. And that was a great experience for me, and to work with her that extensively. It's very challenging. I don't recommend writing one-person shows. It was hard. I've never done it again. But then, I went from that. Every now and then I go back to the idea of writing on actors. And so I was doing that for a while. And that was the source of my inspiration, was I would really like to write a play for that specific person. I'm actually doing that right now for this actor, Brian Dykstra, who I've worked with for 30 years. And he's very much like, you know, he's got a kind of authenticity inside my head that is useful to build things on. And then I'm also writing a play right now for the Alley Theater for their company, because I've worked with those actors a lot. And so, and you know, that's a really of interest to me right now. You know, Ibsen did it, Moliere did it, Shakespeare did it, where you like, you have these people in front of you and you think, what do you build out of that company? So I think that's what happens to me, is I get curious about certain things and then I follow that curiosity. But there have been other times when, you know, where I've just felt very, very, very grief stricken about something. And so I think that the best thing to do is perhaps write a comedy and, you know, and see like how funny you can make something that's really horrifying. What is the meaning of those two realities? Because I think most of my comedies are very dark. I'm interested in, you know, as a writer, I tend to be interested in a lot of blood on the floor, you know, sometimes literally, sometimes just like emotionally. And so I generally have a lot of different places where ideas come from. This is a long answer, so I hope you can cut it together.
Oh, no, okay. It's good. I'm leaving this one in. You just keep going.
Okay, well, I think that's it.
Well, okay, so you get one of these ideas. The muse slaps you upside the head or whatever you said, spoken
yes.
like a writer. I love that image. What's your next step? I wake up in the morning, I have a juice, I write for 3 hours, I go to lunch. Do you write until you stop? Do you have a process?
I do tend to have, in general, I write a lot. You know, sometimes when young writers ask me about it, that is ultimately the only good advice I can present, is that, you know, you can't be afraid of it. You have to be fluid with it. And you can't be afraid of when things run into a wall and then they don't grow. I mean, you know, I always sort of, sometimes I start things and they don't grow the way you want them to, or like they hit a wall and then you can't get past it. I actually, because I have written for film and television and to support my family, and because I'm excited by it a lot of times and stuff, but there are a lot of situations where you have to write lots of very complicated treatments and outlines and be in conversation with people in offices. And I find that wearing and at times actually debilitating, because if you have to think out everything ahead of time, for me, it starts to make the writing itself thin out. And I remain convinced that if you are a little loose, I mean, that if I have a kind of general idea about where something's going, that the best way for me to write it is to just follow the characters, like set it up and then see when they start to move and speak on their own and follow them and kind of shape it a little bit, but not get in their way. Never force a character to do anything that the character doesn't want to do. Sometimes I'll have them and I'll be like, I don't know why you won't do what I want you to do. But I do know to pause at those moments, to not force it, to maybe back up a little bit, that maybe, you know, so that tends to be how I write. And sometimes even given that, things kind of wither, or I'm not ready to write it. And so I need to back up and start something else. I mean, I tend to feel like if I get past like page 11, then I'll probably get to the end of Act 1. And if I get to the end of Act 1, then I will probably get to page 64. And if I get to page 64, then I'll write the rest of it in a few days. Because by that point, things will be tumbling so quickly that, and I will have so much information. And by then, I think by then I sort of understand what the secret subject of it is. It always feels like things that are, like, you know, the muscle of a play reveals itself in the writing, and you can't know what the real subject is unless you let it teach you that. So you have to be in that kind of relationship to the writing process. You can't try to over-control it. Now, having said that, I feel like I have, like, I write a lot. And, you know, there was a period when I was young when I was writing a lot of short plays, and that was great practice for me, you know, just write a 10-minute play based on two people, or do those crazy 24-hour plays. They really drive me crazy. I used to be much better at them. There was something sort of just trust your technique. And I feel like it is sort of like, for me, the truth is, it's just like, you know, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? You practice, you know, and so, and that writing is a little bit, has always been for me a little bit like practicing the piano. If you do it a lot, you'll get better. You know, my son is a pianist, and like when he's practicing a lot, he's amazing. When he takes a couple weeks off, he gets rusty. And I think that that's partly what happens to me is that the, is like, you know, an idea. That's why I'm sort of like, sometimes I get overwhelmed by how many ideas are floating out there, because it's like, oh, brother, like, leave me alone, because they all seem viable. You know, I sort of see how it could work a lot. So I have to, that's why sometimes people bring me ideas, and that frankly rarely works. You know, it sometimes works, but it's challenging to take on somebody else's idea.
You're not the only playwright that has said that to me. I tried to commission a playwright to write a play, and they said to me, that's a great idea, Ken, but I just write my own stuff. I just can't. Yeah. I have so many ideas brewing in my mind. I write what I'm passionate about.
I think, you know, there's actually a project I'm working on with Josh Schmidt, you know, the composer, that I like very much, that somebody brought to both of us. And I'm hopeful that being in collaboration with an artist who we have great energy between us, you know, we sort of, there's one point when I thought, this is a little nerve-wracking because we both talk so much and we both talk really fast. But there is something fluid and vital about that interchange. And I think that in this case, it's going to help put that idea, you know, that came from a third place into action, because it's an action between us. So I think it's possible. So that I do think it's possible, but it's challenging when it's somebody else's idea and I'm supposed to take care of the whole thing. That somehow feels difficult to me.
Yeah, I think it's actually more possible, to your point, more possible with musicals than plays. For some reason, it just seems easier.
Right? I wonder why that is.
So, as I said in the introduction, you're a very prolific writer, but yet you write across a variety of forms of in the entertainment industry. You write for the stage, you write for the small screen, you write for the big screen. Is there a difference between the three styles? And if so, what is that difference?
Yes, I think there is a difference. In the theater and in fiction, there is much more bandwidth for language. That language moves to the front of both of those forms in a way that's really exciting to me. You know, for instance, one of the plays I'm working on right now, you feel the characters kind of crackling against each other, and then there's a moment where something opens up and someone can talk for a good 5 minutes, you know, and that's actually potentially an exciting moment in the theater when there's suddenly an aria or a speech, whatever. You see it, you know, especially in Shakespeare or Moliere or Chekhov, where suddenly the entire room is hushed. You actually can't do that in film and television. There's something about the way the image steps in front of character and story. Like in film, it's extraordinary how much the film catches of the human face, of emotion, how much gets told in, you know, the turn of a head, the blink of an eye. There's an old story about Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon that he just kept telling him to do less, do less, do less, do less. And then he finally said to the great Jack Lemmon, do nothing. So you look at something like Some Like It Hot, and that's Jack Lemmon doing nothing. Well, I mean, and he's a big old ham bone, we know that. But it's quite magnificent how much the camera catches. But because of that, their image steps in front of the narrative in a way that makes language and character, I don't know, I think mostly language take a step back.
So I'm sure I have a lot of writers who are listening right now who would love to start writing for television and film. How did it all happen for you, where you go from this playwright and all of a sudden Hollywood comes a knocking? How did it work?
When I started, I just knew we had no money. My husband and I, we were really broke. And I had sort of luckily landed an agent very early on for this play called Sunday on the Rocks. And then my second play was Spike Heels. And so people were kind of circling a Spike Heels, but it was taking a really long time. And I had done some stuff in New York like really like street cred stuff, you know. There was a theater called Alice's Fourth Floor, and I did a one act there, and I was doing one acts with Naked Angels in their issues projects, and we just had no money. It was really fun, but my plays were funny, and so this like agent, I had the great Esther Sherman was my first agent, and she said to me, you know, you're funny. You could work in television. And so she introduced me to some people in the TV department, and they had me writing sitcom spec scripts. It's how things were done back then. It was very, very different. And then there was a kind of sort of hellish, brutal story, but I eventually landed a job with Gary David Goldberg, and I went out to Los Angeles and worked for him for a few years and got fired very quickly and for no real reason. And then I wrote a play about it called The Family of Man, which is one of my favorite plays that I've ever written. Once I got fired, I thought, that's it. It's done. It was sort of terrifying to me that I thought I was finally making a little money because we were still pretty broke. I mean, we were paying off student loans, and my husband was a stage manager, and so, and he was doing two shows at once. He was always working way downtown, you know, for like On Guard Arts and Soho Rep and stuff like that. So between the two of us, it was sort of like this money coming in for this like year and a half on a sitcom, like, which was terrifying to me because it was such a weird environment. That was like our meager fortune. But, and then I really did think, that's the end of that. And back to writing plays, which I was pretty happy to be doing. But then I had met some people there, and they actually got my play, Spike Heels, into the hands of Stephen Bochco. And so then I got hired to be on NYPD Blue, you know, right at when it was starting. Like, it was the second season when I started writing for NYPD Blue. And that was exciting, you know. That really was. It was a beautiful show to work on. Those two guys, Bochco and David Milch, and, you know, it was challenging and illuminating and fierce and fun. You know, that show back then was like The Sopranos, kind of. It was very innovative, and the writing was exceptional. You know, being sort of smacked around and steered by David Milch was exciting. And horrible too, but I learned an awful lot about writing for television on that show.
And nudity. There was nudity on that show. I remember it was a big deal, right? There were butts.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was like people's butts. Yeah, is what it was.
What I love about that story, just to circle back, is you got fired and you wrote a play about it. The play was a comedy. Was it a comedy, The Family?
You know, it was a comedy. It was a very dark comedy. A lot of people looked at it and said, wow, this is amazing satire about Hollywood. And I got to say, no, it's cinema verite. Because a lot of the scenes, I was so perplexed by that whole culture. It's a very different world. It still is. You know, it's very brutal. It's very male-centric. You know, theater is male-centric too in a totally different way. But it's also, it's Machiavellian, a lot about power politics, like all the time. And I was having trouble figuring out how to make any sense of it. So I would go home and just write down like things that had happened to me that day, conversations that it was really, so I really had a notebook full of these scenes. And so when I got down to writing the play, it was the only time I've ever written a play this way. I had like 30 scenes, and then I started like moving them around to see how they looked next to each other. And then I kind of created a narrative for it. You know, I invented a love story, sort of. You know what I mean? It was like that.
But out of the grief of getting fired, just like you said at the beginning, you found a dark comedy in it and were constructive enough and put a play together. Well, speaking about television, let's talk a little bit about Smash. So how did this come about? Because I've always thought what television needs is something about Broadway on it. So how did the Smash idea come to play?
I have to tell you, I agree with you. I was out there pitching how to do backstage at a theater for a long time. And my agents kept saying, no, nobody's interested. Nobody's interested. They wouldn't even let, you know, people would approach me and say, hey, how come there's never been a show backstage at a New York theater, backstage in a regional theater, backstage in any kind of theater? And I said, you know, I don't know. They won't let me. Everyone says it will never sell. And then when Glee happened, I think that there was more like a wider imagination around what was possible. And Steven Spielberg was out there also pitching. He came up with It Should Be a Musical. And he ended up pitching that to Bob Greenblatt when Bob was still at Showtime. And Bob said, I would like to make that show. And so then they very quickly put, producers on it and Shaman and Whitman on it, you know, as composers of the music. And Spielberg had the idea that you could do a musical, you could build a story and make a musical, and then ultimately, perhaps, if it worked out, put the musical, have it kind of come out of your television set and onto Broadway. And they had all talked about that. And, you know, and then they were looking for a writer, and they did. I mean, I have to say, I was working on The Understudy at the time with Julie White and Mark Paul Gosselaar and Justin Kirk. We were doing that at the Laura Pels for The Roundabout. And someone sent it to Spielberg. He really liked it, very much responded to it. And so did everybody else. And so they brought me on to create the show. And so it moved fairly quickly for a while. And then Bob left Showtime and went to NBC. That took like a year and a half to kind of work out what was going to happen. And then once the show had been moved over to NBC, there was kind of a, how do you reimagine this? Because it was, the original pilot was considerably darker, and people, you know, used the F word. Am I allowed to use the F word on this
you
thing?
You can. You can say fuck all you want there, Teresa.
Okay, yeah. That was the thing. People said fuck. And you know, and sometimes I think I really missed it as we went on, not being able to use that word, because it's, for fuck's sake, it's the theater. But, you know, that was basically how it came together.
And what's interesting to me is I talk to a lot of people outside the city, outside of our bubble, whether it's audience members or whether it's investors of mine from the Midwest, and people loved this show. They loved it. If they had like a peripheral connection to the theater, it was such a great inside look and sneak peek at the world. They were obsessed with it. Yet it didn't obviously run as long as everyone would like it to have run. You weren't involved with season two, right? Is that right?
No. There was a very complicated and sort of ugly political situation that developed, and I became the the roadkill that was left behind as it moved on, which is fine. You know, that, listen, it was painful when it happened. I loved that show. I'm really proud of the work I did on it. I thought it was a shame. I really regret that I didn't have more time to work on it. I know people still talk to me about, you know, it was years ago, and people are still coming up to me on the street and telling me how much they loved that first season. So I think it's a shame. I also really did, at the time, I felt very strongly it's in my nature. I felt very strongly the responsibility and the great opportunity to have that show be a calling card for New York theater to the rest of America and the world. And I mean, I do. I have great love for it. And I'm glad that it was. You know, I think that's really true. Yeah, I still get people from all over the world calling me up to talk to me about that first season.
People still ask me about it when I meet someone. Oh, you're doing a Broadway show. Oh, the only thing I know about Broadway is that television show that smashed. That was fun. Do you think a Broadway themed show can work? Can another one work? Or is there something about just the medium? Or,
oh no, I think it definitely could work. I listen. There were a couple of people who said to me, yeah, but you know, Teresa, that show was never going to work. And I went, it worked. I got it to work for 17 episodes. And I know it can work. I knew how to do it. I had a great line producer. Part of the challenge of it was how much the networks have such tight control over their programming. So many people in place. that have been told that that's their job. It's a very corporate model, and they really needed to loosen up because there were so many. You had to like figure out the story arc for all the characters and the musical itself. You had to, and then figure out which song you were going to ask the guys to write. I mean, I thought their work was beautiful. They worked really hard, those two guys. But it was, you had to be real specific about, this is the song that's going in this episode. And, you know, everything had to go through such a long process of approvals that for me, I was like, you have to back everything up. You have to really commit to things much earlier than you think you're going to have to in terms of a network schedule, in terms of what they're used to. And that was terribly difficult for them to do, you know. But I was like, you cannot cut a song 3 days before we're shooting it, because then we have to shut down. And they had a real hard time, you know, the structural corporate reality had a real hard time with how many different pieces there were to it. As I'm sure you're a Broadway producer, there are a lot of pieces that you have to get working at the same time. And it was totally possible to do that, but it was a little bit, you know, it was a little bit of a high wire act, and that was challenging for them.
Yeah, listen, it's something I talk about with shows all the time, as the producing teams on shows have grown and grown over the years. I've sat in many an ad meeting where I've looked around the room and people waiting for someone to make a decision, or, oh, well, we'll get approval on this. And it takes a week to get approval on a television ad or a print ad or some even marketing initiative. And in that week, we haven't moved any tickets. So we just, I always say that shows like that, it sounds like, you know, major corporate shows, whether they're on Broadway or not, they move like big giant steamships sometimes, and they're very hard to manipulate.
So, yeah, you have to be a little faster on your feet. But, you know, by this point, I've done a lot of work in television, and it's really, you know, you really have to be nimble. You have to, that's why I had such a good time working on this independent feature I made last year, because it reminded me of how fierce and clever you have to be when you're working on a television show, because you have 12, this ship is moving so fast, and you really do have to, in television, you have to shoot 4.5 to 7 pages a day. That's just regular, like, life on a TV show. And so I think that there were like really weird like disconnects around, look, we got to move this fast. So no, you know, because there were a lot of people, you know, Spielberg mostly works, he mostly works in features, and, you know, the guys worked on Broadway. There was like very little experience around just hardcore, this is what TV needs. So that's, I think, really was difficult, but not by any means impossible. I'd love to see someone try it again, because I thought it was a blast.
One of the things I love about you, again, is that I really think you treat your career differently than so many others, especially after all the success you've had. I will never forget the day I'm looking at my inbox and all of a sudden pops up an email from Teresa Rebeck saying, hey, Ken, I think we'd really get along. We want to have lunch. And I was like, I said to my assistant, Teresa Rebeck just emailed me. And I found that just very cool, because you were saying, hey, I think we might get along. You've got some projects. Would you like to take a look at them? Despite, again, all the success you've had, you're still very proactive. Is that something you think all writers have to do at whatever stage of career they are, make opportunities happen today?
Yes. I think that playwrights need to be a little sturdier and proactive, because it's easy to become a victim in this field, you know, to wait for someone to, you know, anoint you. And for a lot of people, I think that becomes painful and sorrowful, even, you know, that they don't know why they haven't been picked. And I think that's a dangerous position to place yourself in. I have to tell you also, the reason I called you that time was because we have this mutual friend, Jim Price, who said to me, Teresa, should call. Jim was the one who told me to do this. And I, at that point, and I'm still at that place, I'm looking for people who I will like collaborating with. It's stressful, this business. And I think that the recommendation of someone I trust that you would also enjoy and trust this person matters to me. I'm kind of on the lookout for those people now. Aren't you? Like, I know a lot of people who are in this position now where it's like, no, I don't want to work with someone who's going to make my life crazy. I want to work with people who love the fact that we get to do this and find joy in it. And there's enough challenge to the thing itself that we have enough on our plates without craziness. That's what I really believe. So that's why I came looking for you.
I love it. Enough on our plate without craziness. It's true. I find that especially younger, I know when I was just starting out, I was so desperate to work. I would just work with anybody, anything. And then I would get myself in these situations where I was taking up so much of my time and energy and not enjoying the process that I was not able to take other opportunities with people that I enjoyed that I think would have led to better things.
Yes, I think so. I think also there really does, there comes a point where life is too short. And so I'm on the hunt for people who don't make my life too short. Yeah.
You've heard that, listeners. She's on the hunt. Teresa Rebeck is hunting right now. Okay, last question, Teresa. My famed, infamous, I should say, genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to see you. For those of you listening, I'm actually Skyping with Teresa right now because she's in Vermont. So the Aladdin genie makes his way all the way to Vermont, knocks on your door and says, Teresa, your plays are fantastic. I loved Smash. I can't believe it's not with us anymore. I want to reward you by granting you one wish. Just one, though, one wish. What is the one thing that drives you so crazy about Broadway, that keeps you up at night, that makes you so angry that you would wish that this genie would change with the snap of his finger? What would that one wish be?
I would like the ticket prices to go way down. I'd like them to be half of what they are. I'd like more people to be able to go. I don't want it to be, oh, can I have two? No. I would like that. I would like there to be more new plays on Broadway. I would like to have Broadway be like the vital soul of the American theater that it was like when Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller and Edward Albee were doing their works on Broadway. That's what I would like. That's one wish, isn't it? Is it one or more than one?
What I love about that answer, Teresa, is at the beginning of this podcast, you were like, I have lots of ideas. I have so many ideas. They just keep popping. And just then, you had two. You had two ideas. And both great ones. I feel
passionately. You know, sometimes people say to me, oh, you can't do new plays on Broadway. And I think, why not? The greatest American plays were on Broadway. It was, you know, it gave birth to mighty, mighty storytelling. And it feels essential to me that still be there. And I don't want to be part of the generation that saw that go away. I don't want to think that we did nothing about it. And it does feel like it's connected to how much it costs to do shows on Broadway and how expensive the ticket prices get. So I'd love it if the community could like get together and start to propose to each other. How do we, you know what I mean? I'd love it if we were, this is the other thing. I'd love it if we were like more of a, I love this. I love what we're doing right now, that you're a producer and you're talking to me, a playwright, about these questions. I'd love it if there was more of that going on, that we could see ourselves as a vital community working together to kind of draw more audiences in. And instead of looking, sometimes I feel like we say to each other so much, what are you going to do? It's just like this. This is just the way it is. And I think there are a lot of things that aren't working just the way they are, and people fight to make them work better. That's what I would like. That's the other ideas. I'd like us all to kind of be in the soup together. You know, I'd like it if producers thought, how can we figure out how to give a playwrights more actors? You know, I get told so often, you got to keep the plays, got to be like 3 to 5, 6 people. I'm like going, you know, the Brits get to have more actors in their plays. Shakespeare gets to have more actors. I think that maybe we should be thinking about that, you know, because sometimes I think the new American play gets kind of put in smaller and smaller boxes, and that there's energy and vitality and people who are still passionate about writing for the theater. And how do we like take that passion and that gift and explode it more instead of squishing it? How many more ideas did I come up with? Thank you for letting me have more.
Well, I love that. And I, of course, love that we're talking as well. You're one of the most prolific writers there are, so I'm starting to feel guilty. We should let you go back and write. I want to thank you so much for being here. We're all going to be looking forward to the next Rebeck contribution to the stage or the screen. I prefer the stage, just saying. So for more on Teresa, do visit her website, TeresaRebeck.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. Stay tuned for next week's podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you then.
Hey guys, don't forget, Spring Awakening returns to Broadway in just a few short weeks in a production unlike anything you could ever imagine. You're going to love it, I promise. Get tickets today, Ticketmaster.com. See you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.